Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Bloody Moon by Harry Harrison Kroll. At rare intervals, usually in the spring of the year, a singular phenomenon known as the Bloody Moon occurs in the cavernous region of Kentucky. The Indians whom Daniel Boone knew in this section had a tradition in connection with a peculiar occurrence to the effect that the Bloody Moon being swift woe to him that sees it. Henry Pearson sat on the steps of his dwelling just after the fall of night. Through the timber along the top of the ridge he caught the first glow of the rising moon. Suddenly the orb shot above the line of timber. Then, for the first time in his life, he had a clear view of the old Indian Bloody Moon. It fascinated him while it horrified him. Seemingly, there was nothing about the sight to occasion fright. Yet, something about it, some magnetic uncanniness, seemed to freeze the very blood in his veins. For a full minute, it glowed at him. Then the planetary face brightened to its normal tint, and the Bloody Moon vanished as suddenly and with as little apparent reason as it had appeared. Pearson did not regard himself as a superstitious person. Still, he reflected he had ample basis for his present unnerved condition. The timbers of the house of Pearson knew to quake at the recurrence of the Bloody Moon. The thing went back, far back, into pioneer days. A century and a half before, the land of which his home was a part had been secured to old Alligator Pearson, a first settler by patent from the territorial government of Kentucky. The aboriginal title was held by an Indian chief named Eagle Fire. In spite of his terror-inspiring name, the Indian was a peaceful old man, and Pearson, brutal and fearless with a handful of pioneers, dispossessed the harmless old man and his tribe by the simple expedient of killing them. Only one was permitted to live, the old chief's daughter. She was a pretty fawn-skinned girl of 16, and Alligator Pearson took her to wife by clubbing her into submission. When the child was born, the princess died, but she never gave in to her white husband in the spirit, for she died with a curse on her lips for the father of her babe. Her last words, reported by the lean women who waited on her in her sickness, were, "Live on, my son, and avenge the blood of your people with the Bloody Moon." When the boy was 18, Alligator Pearson died. It was said tradition the time of the year when Bloody Moon occurred. The neighbors found the stark form of the old pioneer in the trail leading to his cabin. He lay face forward in the path, without mark of violence on his person. Yet he had died in terror, with twisted face and staring eyes. 20 years later, the second Pearson, by a white wife, who followed the princess, was in like manner, at about the same time of year, assassinated. A kindred mystery shrouded his death. The Bloody Moon had been seen an hour previously by his wife, as she had gone down the road to the tobacco field to look for him, supper being delayed and growing cold, and she uneasy and fearful. She found him among the tobacco plants, face to the ground, eyes and mouth full of dust. In his own lifetime, young Pearson had twice known the shock of this swift, inexplicable visitation. The first occasion came about the time he was 10 years old. Grandfather Pearson, third in line from the original pioneer, hale and hearty, had eaten his supper and retired, his bedroom being the roof room under the gable. The rest of the family were in the living room below, his granny knitting, his mother enjoying her after-supper dip of snuff, and his father smoking. Suddenly, the very oaken rafters of the old house quivered from the frightful scream. He dashed with his father up the roof room. They found the old man alone, sitting starkly up in bed, his eyes wide and staring, the breath only a moment since left his body. They found no sign on the old man's person, more than a tiny abrasion on his gray, hairy chest. But the time was spring of the year, at the full of the moon, and the flood of light through the window upon the puncheon floor was red as blood. When he looked again, the glow had mellowed to its normal milk-white. Was it the Bloody Moon that had killed his grandsire? The doctor pronounced the cause heart failure. Who could deny that the practitioner was correct in his diagnosis? For often enough, the human heart does fail when the sins of the father begin their grim visitation down the generations. The details of his own father's taking off he did not often reflect upon. That tragedy was still too poignant, too recent. The time was a year before, at the first full moon in May. His father had visited Bowling Green that day, making the trip on muleback. He was expected home before sundown, but something must have delayed him, for night fell and he had not returned. The moon had risen when mule and rider appeared at the front gate. It was his father's custom to dismount there and halloo for some of the boys to come out and put up and feed the mule. This time, no such familiar call came. Going to the door to see why his father did not dismount and come in, young Pearson saw beast and rider statuesque in the red flood of moonlight, in a vivid vision of tragic death. The mark of the curse of the Indian bloody moon was written indelibly on the sagging, lifeless body of his parent. He carried the old man in and placed him upon the bed in the living room, but no one ever knew how he had come by his death. Now he had just seen in all of its terrible portent the bloody moon, and the time was spring of the year, in the month of May. Pearson rose shakily, going into the house and closing and bolting the door. Perhaps it would be useless precaution, but he felt better. He would have to be cautious now, he told himself. What to guard against, he had not the remotest idea. Still, he would have to take care. It was the very vagueness of the enemy which troubled him most. If it were a man, he would have known easily enough some of the things to do, but this enemy was unnameable, supernatural. It was about 9 o'clock in the evening when Pearson heard one of the mules down at the barn kicking its stall door. He was a farmer and knew well enough that this might mean a valuable farm animal would break its leg if permitted to continue its foolish ways. He went out to the rear gate. The mule had escaped from his stall, dashed out of the lot by leaping the low fence into the tobacco, and was now snorting and cavorting about among the plants in great show of brutish agitation. He called to the beast, with only indifferent results. Meanwhile, he looked about among the plants and in the weeds and shadows back of the stable for some signs of what had caused this unwonted disturbance. The mules were not in the habit of breaking out of their stalls and galloping about in this manner. He clambered the fence, still speaking gently to the mule. The beast made a lateral swing down into a hollow at the spring course below the house. A short distance down the drain was one of the sinkholes characteristic of this cavernous limestone country. The frightened mule disappeared around the clump of bushes which fringed this opening. Pearson could not have explained with any certainty afterward just what actually did occur. He had a vague impression of a dim figure that darted from out of the undergrowth and caught him from the rear, but neither his sight nor feeling could be relied upon. He suffered no sensation of physical contact, much less of pain. All he knew was that he suddenly found his steps arrested, his body sliding through the dust and dry leaves and brush, which clung about the edge of the hole. Nothing he did served to stay his fall. He went tumbling head first into the hole. It seemed that he fell into the very depths of the earth. In his frantic struggles to break his descent, he had a scant idea of distance, but he dimly sensed the depth of the hole to be 100 feet. He landed at the bottom, finally, with plenty of bruises, but no broken bones, friction with the narrow walls aiding him to slack his speed. He stood in absolute darkness. He stretched forth his hand cautiously, finding a continuation of the passage in a horizontal direction. The walls were smooth, and the passageway of a size comfortably to admit his body. He had spent many an hour in exploring the caves of the vicinity. Mammoth Cave, a few miles away, he had known all his life. When his first weakness had passed, he began crawling on hands and knees along the tube. It seemed to follow the general direction of the river bluff, a half mile away. He had never heard of a cave opening out on the face of the bluff. Still, there could be something of the sort. Clearly, he could expect to get out no other way, since escape back up through the sinkhole was impossible. At times, he paused and listened, thinking that something, perhaps the thing that had tripped him up, was following, but no sound reached his ears. It was a premonition, that was all, much more spirit than anything resembling an actuality. After 100 yards, he entered a cavernous chamber. The place was cool, but the air was dry. Away off somewhere he could hear the dull roar of water. He surmised that the stream was Lost River, whose course lay for the most part in the bowels of the earth, with its mouth at the foot of the bluff on Green River. If he could push through and not get drowned in its treacherous waters, he might eventually expect to live. Otherwise, but he did not think of that now. From his pocket he drew a packet of cigarettes and matches. A man might as well die with a good smoke in his mouth as any other way. The light of the match would aid him in getting his bearings, but neither cigarettes nor matches were to be wasted. He put the roll of tobacco in his mouth and struck the match with his thumbnail. The cigarette was never lighted. In the glow of the faint flame, something stared at him, the thing that had been following him. Whether flesh or spirit, he could not have said. It had the form of a woman, and it stood with folded arms and dead, emotionless eyes peering at him. It looked through him, beyond him, rather than at him. In his nervousness, he neglected to extinguish the match quickly enough, and in the interval the thing measured him, his strength and prowess, and the next instant it was upon him. The first encounter was swift and illuminating. It was human, and it was merciless. He broke the first clinch with army tactics, sidestepped and waited, drawing his breath as silently as possible so as not to betray his position, an expedient his assailant did not observe, for he could hear her labored breathing a dozen steps away. He considered, with some rapid mental calculation, the disadvantages against which he worked. The other had the advantage of being on familiar ground and accustomed to the blackness of the place. She knew the exit to the place, if any existed, and how to cut off any chance retreat. But he reasoned that there must be an opening, if nothing more than the mouth of Lost River, and he must play for that one fact alone. He doubted not that this was the inevitable mouth of the Bloody Moon. Whether a ghost of the Indian princess whom his ancestor had abused, or descendant of that child born to transmit the curse, mattered little in the long run. The one thing which he accepted was that the curse was by way of being visited upon him, and, in the law of probabilities, he had scant chance of escaping the fate that had taken off in turn every male heir of the house since the days of old Alligator Pearson. He did not know what the others had seen, what his grandfather had seen that night in the roof room, or his father had encountered on his way home from Bowling Green. Nothing was vouchsafed for him that he might defend himself intelligently. All he knew was that he was in for a fight to the bitter finish. His wind came back to him presently. He reached forth a cautious hand. The floor was smooth. The walls were at the tips of his fingers. He strained his ear for some sound from the enemy. Her breathing, too, had become normal. He was, in fact, uncertain whether or not she was still there. Then, with silent deftness, he drew himself to his feet. He had hoped to sidestep swiftly upon gaining his equilibrium, duck again, and by a second lateral leap evade the attack his movement would inevitably bring about, unless he miscalculated the venom of his enemy. The plan was perfect, except that he had not taken account of his creaking joints. The snapping of his ankles betrayed his strategy. The thing was upon him again. He fought now with deadly earnestness, nor was he a weakling. The labor in the tobacco fields had tutored his muscles in flexibility and endurance. His overseas service had taught him some tricks of this fighting game. He beat out with his fists. He took the clenches and played for blood. Always the hands worked for his throat. And what curious hands they were, long and murderous with nails like razors. Once they caught in his face, and he felt the warm blood drip upon his defending arms. For a moment, he fancied he had gained the ascendancy, when by a terrific blow, with no better aim than blind instinct, he smashed the unseen face. The thing staggered back, but he had hardly regained his own scattered faculties before the battle was resumed with a bloody determination. He sidestepped whenever possible, retreating as opportunity offered. He had to feel his way carefully, however, for the jump-off is always a menace in cave exploration, and he was satisfied that there was a subterranean cliff leaping down to the waters of Lost River. As he retreated, he became aware that the roar of the stream was increasing in intensity. He sloshed into some water once, by which token he knew the passage was going further down into the earth. A sudden fear, such as takes possession of one in the darkness when he imagines that he is in the act of stepping off, compelled him to hands and knees. He put his foot back. Less than a yard back, his toe went suddenly over an edge. His instinct and knowledge of caverns had not played him false. Had he stayed on his feet and continued his retreat, he would have crashed to his doom far down below into the hole through which the waters of Lost River now roared. Had the woman paused, expecting him to go over the ledge, he remembered now several yards back he had sensed a branching of the passages. Cool air came from one direction, warm air from another. The cool air, it was evident, blew from the water whose roar filled his ears. The warm air doubtless came from an inlet somewhere at the surface. The thought that he had gone the other way he might have beat up to freedom sickened him. There was nothing to do now but renew the attack and gain the other passage, the mouth of which he was probably guarding. Every instant when he was fighting the creature, he expected to feel a sharp thrust and a death reaction to some poison, such as had probably taken off his father and grandfather. But he could not wait long here in action. Already his muscles were stiffening, and the bruises and abrasions about his body growing painful. He swore under his breath. Old Alligator Pearson had been slain back there in those distant days, and he had deserved his punishment. Why couldn't the curse have stopped with the real offender? That was the trouble with one of those crimes. They somehow were never expiated until about the 10th generation. There remained nothing but to return to the battle. He got his blood going by waving his arms and flexing his muscles, and then he started forward cautiously. He was making his way steadily along when suddenly he all but stumbled over the woman. The sound of his footfalls had been muffled by the roar of Lost River, and she had not heard his approach until he was upon her. The battle recommenced with a fury that broke no quarter. The rest that had chilled and stiffened him more than had refreshed him appeared to have been as wine to the savage Amazon. He pushed her away from him, striking blindly again and again, but without avail. Her claws slashed his face and arms. Once she caught one of his fingers between her teeth and nearly bit it off. The terrible pain blinded him into semi-consciousness. With this as an advantage, she pushed him back toward the chasm. Nearer and nearer he felt himself forced to the brink of the precipice. In a sudden reaction of angry energy, he determined that his foe should die with him. If she lived in the flesh, she should now die in its mortality. His foot felt the brink of the jump-off. The time had come. He had been falling back, trying to keep at arm's length from the woman, but now he changed his tactics and made a desperate clinch. He gave a frantic pull, and together they went over the brink. In a protracted fall through the Stygian blackness, he had some curiously clear impressions. The roar of the water seemed to rise to meet them. The draft of the flue was sharp and filled with chill particles of moisture. The woman who fell with him accepted their common fate with a strange, dull passivity. Her body was warm, and not without a certain charm of touch, which instinct told him was that of youth. It was a curious paradox that after many minutes of furious battling, in which nothing but death could close the issue, his hand should be upon her breast, and that he could feel the flutter of her heart. Then came the impact. The chill waters of Lost River seemed to gather them up in a roaring, breathless embrace. He had always been a good swimmer. The waters of Green River could bear testimony as to that. Instinctively, he held his breath. The swirl carried him and the woman swiftly away from the churning froth where the hurtling waters reached the earth again. It came to him that he was not gone after all. He had not considered the saucer, which is always to be found at the foot of a fall, hollowed out by ages of falling water to a depth of many feet. His courage revived by the turn of fortune. He began to figure his way out. From his knowledge of the locality, he judged that he was less than 100 yards from safety, where the subterranean stream came finally to the light in the waters of Green River. If he could last for 5 minutes, life would be his. The woman seemed lifeless in his arms now, but she did not hinder his movements. The sweeping waters carried them both like corks. He found, too, that in spite of the low roof of the stream's bed, his head more often than not emerged in a pocket of air that permitted him a long breath. The passageway widened, narrowed again, then the waters, half joyfully, half vengefully, suddenly evicted him out of the bowels of the earth into the rocky bed of a Green River. The woman was still with him, her hair floating on the cottony water, the brilliant light of the high riding moon tracing her features into a picture far from unlovely. He dragged both her and himself to the sandy bank. Her features were Indian, but with a pleasant variant due to her unmistakable white blood. Her berry brown skin and gypsy hair came from her aboriginal ancestry, the rotundity of chin and mold of cheek from her Nordic stock. Her clothing was a nondescript garment of skin and rags, and even the bruises about her body and the clotted blood and cuts about her neck, arms and shoulders did not mar the beauty of her maidenhood. Her body rested limply on the sand, the last of the curse of the Indian bloody moon. He dropped to his knees by her and began chafing her hands. Between times, he built a fire by flaking two flint rocks together, Indian fashion, and catching the sparks in rotten wood. Thereafter, he worked with her to better purpose, and presently she was sufficiently revived for him to remove her to the house, where he turned her over to the tender ministrations of his mother. The rest of the story came by degrees over a long period of time, while the girl learned the language of her white ancestry. Much of what she recounted was merely her own tradition, but it pieced in well with the facts in young Pearson's possession and was entirely plausible. The son of the Indian princess and old alligator Pearson had taken to the caves after he had grown, wifing an Indian girl from a remnant of an allied tribe. In course of time, he had killed his father, passing the curse of his mother onto sons and daughters of his own. In course of time, he had died. The charge had been carried faithfully out by each succeeding generation, usually with a poison made from the venom of a moccasin snake and certain plants of whose identity had become lost to the girl. And so, because of the pressure of getting food and the life under the earth, her people had all passed away, leaving her to complete the curse. She had lost the formula for the poison. In desperation, she had worked out the present plan, hoping to get the last of the Pearsons into the cave and starve him to death, or drown him over the falls of Lost River. The rest of this tale is another story. But so far as the house of Pearson was concerned, the bloody moon superstition became merely an old wives' tale. The next Pearson in line was a fawn-skinned boy who would never know a sense of dread when the month of May brought a blood-red moon in the evening sky. The Grim Passenger by Donald Edward Kehoe. Because of the ridicule generally attaching itself to anyone admitting the possibility of the supernatural, I have until now refrained from setting forth the details of certain events which apparently led to a widely known and regretted disaster in mid-Atlantic several years ago. But the opening of the tomb of King Tutankhamun and the attending publicity brought the matter back to my mind, and I shall offer it to the public to believe or not as it chooses. Even now I do not admit that there was anything supernatural about it. That there was something strange and terrible about it, no one will deny. For obvious reasons, certain names have been omitted or changed, but with these exceptions, I have related everything exactly as it occurred. In my position as secretary to the president of the Blank Museum of London, I have charge of the sending out of expeditions in search of valuable specimens, ancient and otherwise. For some time during the years of the early 1900s, we had been on the trail of a mummy case supposed to contain the dead body of a certain king whose name is to be found in a history of centuries long past. Credible information having at last obtained as to the location of the tomb containing the mummy, I sent for a man whose name may be remembered even now as that of a famous museum supplier. A man who was well versed in such work, and who was thoroughly dependable because of his matter-of-fact and common-sense nature. I shall call him Thomas D. Stevenson. Acquainting him with all the facts at my disposal, I gave him an order for such equipment as he would need and sufficient funds to cover all expenses of the trip. 2 days later, he left London for a spot not very far from that at which the present activities are taking place. Less publicity was given the matter, however, than at the present time, because of reasons which concerned a slight difficulty in regard to the law. After reaching his destination, Stevenson encountered obstacles in obtaining guides and other natives to help in the excavation. They were finally obtained, however, and after considerable effort, the Englishman and his party located the long-lost tomb. Within a few days, the main entrance to the great vault was partially uncovered, and preparations were made for opening it. when the native suddenly drew off to one side, muttering and casting awestruck looks at the door which bore in ancient language an inscription that had been cut into the metal that formed the outer part. When Stevenson peremptorily ordered them back to their work, the head native approached them tremblingly and pointed out a little, dried-up old man who seemed to hold a position of importance among the others. "Master," he said, "he has told us the meaning of the words, and we are afraid."
"You fools," Stevenson stormed. "What is there on that door to frighten men living hundreds of years after it was erected?"
"It says," answered the cowed native, "that he who sleeps there has left his spirit to guard his body, and that any who touch it shall die."
"Damned nonsense," roared the other, and went on trying to drive the men back to their work. But neither threats, cajolery, nor offers of higher pay would move them. The little old man had frightened them with his translation of the words on the door, and the inbred superstitions of generations did not rest. Seeking a full solution of the problem, Stevenson asked the old native for a translation of the warning, and this is what he heard: "Turn ye away, lest you become as I. On them who heed not my warning shall my curse fall, and it shall so be until my body rests again undisturbed." At the bottom of these words was a seal bearing the profile of a crowned head. Even Stevenson felt a vague uneasiness and misgivings at this, but he shook off his doubts with a laugh at his momentary weakness and again attempted to force the men to the work. Finding them determinedly against it, he dismissed them and set about getting other aid, which was no small matter in that out-of-the-way place. Finally, a nondescript outfit of drifters and ne'er-do-wells was assembled, and the vault was open. To the relief of Stevenson and the disappointment of the men, there was very little treasure found, although this is now believed to have been in a second vault nearby. The much-desired mummy case, however, lay in state on a terraced stonework covered with symbols and signs, which later proved to be an almost complete history of the life of the dead king. On closer examination, Stevenson was startled to find reproduced in the center of the case the identical warning that had been seen on the door. For a moment, the Englishman had an almost overpowering impulse to drop the whole thing and return to England and the museum empty-handed. He quickly stifled this and curtly gave the order that started the body of the dead monarch on its journey, far from his wished-for resting place, to the bustling, unmindful city of London. Then began the journey to the nearest seaport. Singularly restless and impatient for one of his stolid nation, Stevenson rushed his men, already tired from work, until fever set in and delayed him while he attended to the sick. Instead of yielding to rest and recognized remedies, the fever took a more malignant form, and before the party reached the port, 5 men had succumbed. The others, a curious fear having descended upon them, cursed the money. Stevenson and the expedition heartily and impartially, nor did they lose any time in severing their connection with the outfit. Once the mummy case was on board the ship and their pay was in their pockets, Stevenson, his mind wearied and in a turmoil from the trying happenings of the preceding weeks, turned in at his hotel, hoping to enjoy a good rest, but instead tossed and turned throughout most of the night, arising early, preparatory to embarking on his ship. He was astonished to find a local police official awaiting him. "What is it?" demanded the Englishman brusquely, short-tempered from worry and lack of sleep.
"Sir, it is that we wish you to identify some bodies," answered the smiling, suave official, as if he were suggesting a stroll in the cool of the morning.
"Bodies?" gasped the other. "Whose? What bodies?"
Sir, they are 5 men who are said to have come with you yesterday. Last night they became very drunk in one of the places down on the old docks and started a brawl in which several were hurt, and 3 of your party were killed. The other 2 attempted escape when our men arrived and were fatally wounded before they submitted to arrest. One died at once and the other but a few minutes ago." It was with an effort that Stevenson shook off the depression that this news brought to him and complied with the police regulations in identifying the dead men
and giving his rather slight knowledge of each one. This done, he hurried back to his hotel, and at once proceeded to his ship, endeavoring all the time to shake off a foreboding that had begun to be a very part of his mind. Insistently, the thought hammered itself into his every waking moment and brought him sinister dreams, that of all the men who had entered the forbidden tomb and had defied the warning that had protected the dead king for centuries, he alone still lived. Again and again he told himself that the deaths were accidental and in the course of natural events. Fever was a common thing, and scores of men were killed in such quarrels as had occurred on the preceding night. Then before him would come a vision of the mummy case with its silent warning, and his bolstered up confidence and courage would fall like a house of cards. He had been guiltier than the men who helped him in violating that warning. How long would he escape the vengeance of the power that had taken the lives of the rest? Already unwell from the efforts in the desert, Stevenson rapidly became worse, until by the time the ship had reached England, he was a mental and physical wreck. Then it was that we of the museum heard of his plight and went to his aid, removing him to a hospital and the mummy case to the basement of the museum. At the bedside of the sick man, several of the lesser officials of the institution listened to his story, but even when related the details of the horror that had attended every moment since the removal of the dead king from the tomb, they raised their eyebrows and nodded to each other, an expression of their belief that the heat and the solitude had been a little too much for him. Little attention was paid then, when at the close of his narrative, Stevenson raised himself up on one shoulder, and his eyes, gleaming in a fierce, unnatural way, cried out, "Don't let them keep the mummy. Have him taken back. Take him back before it is too late." An attendant rushed up quickly and soothingly pushed the sick man back into his bed, while the others withdrew, hardly giving a second thought to the words of the man they had just left, feeling only a natural sorrow at the affliction which his long stay in the tropics had brought him. 2 days later, Stevenson died, raving about the mummy and uttering warnings to the effect that it should be taken back to the tomb. His words were ascribed to delirium, and no attention was paid to them at the time. Then the mummy case was brought to the central exhibition room and placed within a case especially prepared for it. While someone was studying the symbols on the case, the inscription was noted and its meaning found by referring to our records of ancient languages. But the thing was taken more as a joke by everyone in the museum than as anything of serious meaning. And then, without further warning, tragedy invaded the museum itself. For the very next morning, the night watchman was found dead, directly in front of the mummy case, his eyes wide open, with a look of mortal terror in them, while his face was rigid and drawn with fear, as if the man had died while looking on something so dreadful that his mind had instantly become crazed, even as his overtaxed heart burst from horror. No reason could be assigned, and after a searching investigation, a verdict was reached by the coroner's jury that death was due to failure of the heart. The unnatural pose in which the dead man was found to be due to his fear of dying, being added to by the darkness and silence in which he was when the attack seized him. This was most unsatisfactory, but no other explanation was forthcoming. Hardly had we recovered from this shock, when early one afternoon I was startled to hear the sound of a fall, and rushing into the president's room I found him lying on the floor, breathing his last. As I raised his head up from the floor, the dying man gasped out, "Send back the mummy. Send him back to—" Before he could finish the words, he sank back limply. A quickly summoned doctor pronounced his death due to nervous disorder that had affected the heart. That ended the day of the mummy in the museum. Before another day, we had it carried to the basement, although it was with difficulty that we could prevail on anyone to go near the now greatly feared body. Arrangements were underway for sending it back to its former resting place when we received a call from Basil G. Stoddard, the representative of an American museum of no small fame. Mr. Stoddard wished to see the cause of the mysterious events, which had by that time been well discussed in the newspapers. He was insistent, and I finally gave in to the extent of allowing him to enter the room where we had locked up the mummy case. The upshot of it all was that he decided to buy it from us, although we told him every known happening that had been attributed to its baleful influence. I do not believe any of the deaths were caused by this dried-up old body, he said. As for the warning, it was only a natural desire to keep robbers from prying into his tomb that caused him to take such a course. Knowing the superstitious nature of the people, he saw that such a caution would be his best protection. The value to me and to the institution I represent is in the mummy itself, and the case, which has certain unusual figures worked into it. Well, I shall be glad to be rid of it, I returned. I do not like to believe that there is anything connecting the deaths and the mummy itself, which cannot be explained by psychology of fear. But at any rate, we shall all breathe more easily when the thing is no longer under our care. Just 1 week later, Stoddard sailed for New York, with flags flying bravely, bands playing inspiring music, and hundreds of passengers waving goodbye to their friends on shore. The then largest ship of her class slowly dropped downstream and commenced her maiden voyage, with not a thought of anything but a wonderful journey before them on that floating palace. The passengers began their customary plans for shortening the time and making it most agreeable. There was but one exception to this. One passenger lay deep in the hold, unmoving, apparently an inanimate though rather gruesome bit of cargo. But who knows but there radiated from that dead body a terrible malevolence which was destined to bring death and disaster to the gay crowds that thronged the decks above. Who knows but that this malevolent influence, all powerful because of centuries through which it had existed and grown, perhaps penetrated to the minds of those who guided the destinies of the great ship, that it did not give to the captain of the vessel an all-consuming desire to break the highest records for speed to the American port, and that this desire would render him careless of danger, of reports of drifting icebergs, causing him to drive his ship further and further into peril. Who knows but that this influence, if such there was, vicious, unpitying, and ruthless in its desire for vengeance at its violated warning, perhaps swerved each mind to its purpose, even reaching up to the lookout in the crow's nest and making him slow in seeing that vast floating danger which loomed up in the path of the ship, carrying those precious souls until the colossal mass of ice crashed into the oncoming ship, crushing it like a shell and dooming many of those on board to death or separation from loved ones, and the others to terrible memories that will live with them forever. And perhaps, as that once proud ship settled below the wave to its final resting place, the dead king exulted in fiendish triumph as he went down to rule over the world of dead about him in that greatest of tombs, the steamship Titanic.